Good morning. The Senate Finance Committee meeting is called to order at 9:04. Today is Wednesday, March 25th, 2015. Present at the table, Senator Hoffman, Senator Bishop, Vice Chairman Michicki, Senator Dunleavy, and myself, Senator McKinnon. Senator Olson should be with us shortly. I know that he's meeting with constituents this morning, and Senator Kelly is away from the Senate Finance Committee on other duties. On today's agenda, we'll have before us SB 33, Fees for Tires, followed by SB 49, Civil Legal Service Fund, followed by SB 32, Timber Sales. Is there any items to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to invite Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director of the Tax Division, as well as Anna Kim, Chief of Revenue Operations, to the table. Again, we have before the committee SB 33, an act relating to the remittance of tire fees and providing for an effective date. Ms. Kim.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. Anna Kim from the Department of Revenue Tax Division. Excuse me. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 33, Fees for Tires. The bill simply changes the due date of the tire fee return and payment from 30 days following the calendar quarter to the last day of the calendar quarter in which new tires were sold or studs were installed. The reason we're bringing this forward is a few issues with our taxpayers is that three of the four calendar quarters, the returns and payments are due prior to the last day of the month. This has caused a little bit of taxpayer confusion in filing and has resulted in late fees and penalties being assessed on them. So would you like me, Madam Chair, to walk through the bill, the sections of the bill?
Or
certainly. Okay. Section 1 of the bill changes the due date, as I had said before, from the 30 days to the last day of the calendar quarter in which the tires are sold or studs are installed. So what that means is for July, October, and January, as it stands currently, they're due on the 30th. However, they do have 31 days, so this bill would change that to the end of the month, so it would be July, October, and January 31. Section 2 aligns the payment dates used to determine the timely pay credit with the new dates in Section 1. The timely pay credit is intended to compensate taxpayers for their expense and effort collecting the tax from the customer and remitting the tax to the state. The timely pay credit allows taxpayers to retain 5% of the taxes we collect, not to exceed $900 per quarter. Section 3 applies to the due date change to the first calendar quarter after the effective date of this act. And the final section, the act takes effect immediately. The fiscal note attached to the bill is zero, and we have no new positions proposed. However, we do have a reduction in a change in revenues of general fund of, we're approximating $5,000. How that's broken down is we feel that the timely pay credit loss would be $2,500, the penalty would be approximately $2,500, and the interest would be less than $50.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members on the bill? Senator Michicki.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a constituent that commented on this bill. Could you clarify for the committee that there is no increase, that this is an existing tire fee and all you're doing is changing the date? Or perhaps I should ask you, is there an increase in the per tire fee associated with this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, no, there is no increase.
Thank you. Just wanted to clarify that for my constituent. That was my understanding as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Kim, this is a quarterly fee. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And I went through the records to see we're collecting about $1.3 million on the fee as far as state revenue goes, and it appears that the penalties and interest over time have been going down. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
So is there still a the administration still believes there's a reason that some people don't know that their fees are due?
Madam Chair, one of the things that we've tried to actively do is work with our taxpayers, communication and education about filing. As a result, you've seen a reduction in the penalty and interest over time. We feel it's just a simple administrative change to just be more efficient.
Thank you, Ms. Kim. For the committee's information, in 2012, the penalties and interest for the tire fee was $20,026. In 2013, it was $18,435. In 2014, it was $3,477. So a significant drop in penalties to taxpayers. So I wanted to commend the administration for working with taxpayers. Ms. Kim, could you tell us what happens if the last day of the month falls on a Saturday or a Sunday? Because that's not actually clarified in the language before us. So how will that be different and not be confusing for general taxpayers?
Madam Chair, if I could call on Brandon Spanos to talk about more details related to the variations in the filing.
Thank you, Ms. Kim. Online, Brandon Spanos is in Anchorage. He's the Deputy Director of the Tax Division. Mr. Spanos, did you hear the question?
Yeah, yes, Madam Chair, I did. And the answer to the question is in Title 4305, and I don't have the section memorized, but it it allows for if the due date falls on a weekend or a holiday, that the due date becomes the next business day. And that's for all of our tax types. 05 covers tire fees as well.
Thank you very much. Senator Olson.
And I might add, if I could, on the penalties and interest, 2014 is the year that we rolled out our revenue management system. So our excise tax auditors were completely engaged in designing, developing, and implementing a new tax system. And there were no audits done that year, which is part of the reason the penalties and interest was lower.
Thank you for that additional information, Mr. Spanos. Hence the question, do we really need the bill?
Madam Chair, the bill, we still have occasionally a taxpayer that will file on the 31st, and they will claim that, well, the first quarter, my filing due date was the 30th of the month, and therefore I was unaware that it wasn't the end of the month. And that's the argument they've given at appeal. We've looked at they've brought up the fact that all of our other quarterly filings are due at the end of the month, and why isn't this one? And we're simply trying to be proactive in aligning it with other quarterly filings.
Thank you, Mr. Spanos. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Several questions, I guess. What is the tire fee? What was the justification for the tire fee? And do all other states have such a fee? And if not, what are those states?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to the other states part of the question. I would assume they have, however, I haven't looked into that. The tire fee itself is, well, the legislation was created in order to collect a fee to assist in revenue, the studded tire specifically for the deterioration of roads. The fee is twice as much as the regular tire fee in order to assist with the needs of the state.
So, Madam Chair, is there a differentiation between a regular tire and its fees and a studded tire having a higher fee?
Through the chair, if I understood the question correctly, are you asking if there's a different fee on each type of tire, a studded tire as and a new tire?
Yes.
The new tire fee is actually on all new tires sold. So the $250 fee is on both regular tires that are subject to the tax as well as the studded tires. And then, in addition, a studded tire has an additional $5 fee. So if you buy a new studded tire, you would be paying the $750, whereas if you just buy a tire without studs designed for use on a highway, then it would be $250.
And I guess over the years, it's been reported by DOT that the largest damage to the paved roads in Alaska are as a result of studded tires, which runs into the tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm wondering, how do we compare with other states as it relates to the fees for studded tires?
Through the chair, I would have to look into that and get back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Spanos. Ms. Kim, do you have a response to Senator Hoffman?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I just wanted to make sure that you understood the classification of studs in the current legislation is classified as heavy studs, which means weighing 1.1 grams. We can get you the information and follow up with the committee on comparisons with other states.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Any other questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, Ms. Kim, what year did we start collecting, just again to clarify for my constituent, what year did we start collecting the tire fee?
Well, the original bill was during 2003, so I'm assuming 2003, 2004, around there.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 33, an act relating to remit of tire fees and providing for an effective date. Is there anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify on Senate Bill 33? Is there anyone online? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. We'll be setting this bill aside. I did want to welcome, I think it got cut off, Senator Olson, you've been here for some time. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
The next item before the committee is Senate Bill 49. Civil Legal Service Fund, an act allowing appropriations to the Civil Legal Service Fund from court filing fees. Is the sponsor in the room Senator McGuire or Senator McGuire's staff, Geneva? Genevieve, I'm sorry. Your name for the record and if you'd introduce the bill.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, Genevieve Watusik, staff to Senator McGuire. She apologizes if she's in another meeting at this time. This bill is Senate Bill 49, an act allowing appropriations for the Civil Legal Services Fund from court filing fees. This bill is designed to help fund civil legal services for low-income Alaskans. It will provide a mechanism for funding the Alaska Legal Services Corporation by allowing the legislature to appropriate up to 25% of filing fees paid to the Alaska court system during the previous fiscal year. It was established in 1966 to address civil legal aid needs of low-income Alaskans. It's not a state agency, but is instead a nonprofit charitable 501c3 whose funding comes from a variety of state, federal, and private sources. It has a zero fiscal note from the courts, and I have Nicole Nelson here from Alaska Legal Services to testify as well.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? I have an analysis on the fiscal note, and so currently the court system collects a little bit over $2 million, at least in FY14 they did, in fees. And so an annual appropriation for the general fund could be up to $550,000.
Through the chair, yes. They collected $2.252 million last year, so up to a quarter of that would be $563,225 if you allow it up to that much.
Thank you. And can the legislature already do this?
We haven't. So right now, Senator McKinnon, we give money through our budget, a percentage, but we don't actually designate funds every year. So this would allow it to. Right now it's in our operating budget.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Any additional questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
Yeah.
Through the chair, thank you. Senate Bill 49 doesn't require, I mean, the thing that's not any different, a year like this, there's not going to be an appropriation. It simply allows the legislature to appropriate up to 25% of the filing fees. Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
So if we get back in the position where we're not in the current state economically, we could appropriate the funds to that, to the Civil Legal Services Fund.
Through the chair, correct.
Thank you.
Is there any additional questions from committee members?
I have one question to clarify for the record, but could we bring the director up, Madam Chair?
Senator Michicki.
And we're ready.
The director of?
The Civil Legal Services Fund.
Certainly. If she approached the microphone, identify yourself for the record. Senator Michicki has a question.
I am Nicole Nelson, and I'm the executive director of Alaska Legal Services.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nicole, just wanted to clarify, there was some concern that these funds are used for abortion funding. And I just wanted you to please get it on the record whether or not Alaska Legal Services Corporation uses any of the funds for that purpose.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm sorry. Through the chair, Senator Michicki, thank you for asking that question. And no, we do not. We're prohibited by federal law from using any funds that come through our organization to do abortion-related litigation. We also are prohibited from participating in other more controversial areas, like, for instance, representing people who are currently incarcerated or people who are undocumented. We have, yes, there are federal restrictions that prevent us from using these funds for those purposes.
Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy.
So can you describe what the bulk of your services consist of?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Dunleavy, that question. Just if I might step back just a second and explain a little bit about Alaska Legal Services. We're a nonprofit law firm that provides free legal aid to low-income Alaskans statewide, and we've been doing this for 45 years through our 11 offices that are located both in urban and rural communities. And we strive to serve clients with their critical unmet civil legal needs. And I think... the following scenarios are typical of those we see from people seeking our services in any given day in one of our 11 offices. We might have a parent who is being physically abused and fears losing custody of their children or lacks the financial support to leave their spouse seeking our help. We have grandparents who are caring for their grandchildren but have been unable to enroll them in school or get the health care they need because they lack the proper documentation to access those services. We may have a fisherman who has taken out a loan to get his boat repaired by an out-of-state mechanic, and the boat comes back and blows up during the middle of fishing season, and he's unable to continue to fish for the season. Or it may be the case that a veteran who has served his country has been denied veterans benefits, despite the fact that he's earned those through his service to his country, and lacks the ability to work at this point. And, you know, for all of these problems, there's a legal solution, a civil legal solution. But unlike in criminal cases where if you're accused of a crime, you are guaranteed a court-appointed attorney, in the civil realm, there is no such right. And so for folks and thousands like these type of folks and folks, thousands other Alaskans like them, ALSC is really their only hope to accessing the civil justice system. And each year we serve about 2,500 people in similar situations. And this, because most of those folks, their children in their households, we have an impact on about 6,000 families per year.
Senator Dunleavy.
So from your perspective, tell me from your perspective what, if this bill is passed, what it will do for your organization.
Sure. So if, thank you for the question through the chair. If this bill is passed, it will help us meet the unmet legal needs. So right now, we are forced to turn away one person, one family, for everyone that we help. And we're turning them away not because their cases lack merit and not because there aren't laws that would protect them. We're turning them away because we don't have the resources. And, you know, we're really doing everything we can to meet those needs. We are really cost efficient and effective. An average case is about $600. 80% of our cases we resolve without ever having to go to court. We pay our attorneys far below the market rate. It's like a first-year attorney in our office makes about $42,000 a year. We are leveraging dollars every which way we possibly can with donated office space and volunteers, but yet we still have to turn people away. And so if this bill were passed, it would provide additional funding so that we might be able to continue to serve those folks that we have to turn away at this point.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many counselors do you have on staff?
Sure. We have approximately 25 attorneys statewide, and then we have a large network of pro bono attorneys who volunteer their time as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Is there a reason that we don't change the licensing requirement to require volunteer service as part of a licensing renewal?
I'm not sure that I'm the right person to answer that question. A bar association is in charge of licensing requirements. They do have, as part of the bar rules, there's an aspirational goal of asking attorneys to volunteer 50 hours per year to do so, and there are a lot of attorneys who are very generous and volunteer for us through that program.
Thank you. That I'd like to move to the public hearing if there's not any further questions.
Actually, Madam Chairman, I do.
Senator Olson.
Ms. Nelson, I guess one of the questions I have is you don't want to get involved in civil litigation, no criminal.
Yes, sir.
And do you deal with mediation, arbitration as well?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, we only deal with civil cases, not criminal cases. And if in an appropriate case their mediation was appropriate or arbitration, yes, we would help in that circumstance. Yes.
No further questions, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Thank you for joining us at the table. Let me move into public hearing. The public hearing for Senate Bill 49 is now open, an act allowing appropriations to the Civil Legal Service Fund from court filing fees. I would advise the committee that Nancy Mead's available for question. First, in Juneau, Marie Darlin, AARP. Marie Darlin, thank you.
Darlin.
Your name for
the
record.
Good morning. My name is Marie Darlin. And I'm the coordinator for AARP in Juneau for our advocacy issues. And we just want to say that we are in full support of this bill. You have our letter, and I'm not going to read all of that, but we just do want to say that we do support this bill because it does set up a more stable funding mechanism than for the Alaska Legal Services, which is really an important part of the services that are needed by some of our senior people who really need this help and have no other means to get it. And so without access, you know, to legal support like this, seniors are vulnerable then for many things which can affect their lives, and they would be subject to all kinds of unfair or exploitive practices and things like that, that unless they have something like Alaska Legal Services to go to for help, there's nowhere else they can go if they are low-income seniors. And with the increasing senior population that we have coming up, we also feel that a more stable funding source is going to be helpful to them. And for that reason, we fully support the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
The next person off net, Linda Towork from Unalakleet. Linda, are you there?
Yes, I am. My name is Linda Towork. I'm from Unalakleet. I'm speaking on behalf of the Native Village of Unalakleet, and we are in support of Senate Bill 49. We did ask Alaska Legal Services Corporation from Nome to come down and assist elders who did not have bills in place. I have surveyed elders ages 70 and over, and they number about 45 to 50. And of those ages 70 and older, only I would guess anywhere from about 5% of them had wills. We asked Alaska Legal Services to come down on behalf of the elders only, and we set up only a day for the lawyer to work, and she was able, with the help of the advance will questionnaire that she had sent and asked each elder to fill out, she was able to write wills for 11 people, 11 elders, specifically in reference only to the military. We wanted to bring this out. Of those 11 wills that were written, six of them were military veterans. Of those 11 wills that were written, four of them were widows of veterans. And we are highly appreciative of the work and the effort that Alaska Legal Services Corporation does, not only for the military, not only for the elder, but for the full spectrum of ages of those who need civil help in the state of Alaska. I thank you for your time.
Linda, thank you for coming out today and testifying to Senate Finance Committee in support of SB 49. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, the next person online, Monina Willis from Anchorage. Monina, if you could identify yourself for the record, any affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Hello, my name is Monina Willis, and I'm a lifelong resident of Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm speaking in support of SB 49.
Welcome.
Great. I'm a client of Alaska Legal Services now in 2015 and back in 2008 when I had a newborn daughter. And Alaska Legal Services represented me in a domestic violence protective order and also a child custody case after my daughter's father filed for custody. It was very important for me to have a free attorney and it made a huge difference in my life at the time. I had left an abusive relationship and I'm kind of starting over new and didn't have any money at the time and also a newborn baby. And after he filed for the custody at the time, I was unable to represent myself as I was, you know, still nervous to speak about issues and the history. So I felt that Alaska Legal Services did not only just represent me legally, but they were the voice that I needed when I was nervous to speak about some of the history. Having a free attorney made a huge difference, and I just feel that with Alaska Legal Services, they help hundreds of Alaskans like me each year with legal issues, and with no funding, the Alaska Legal Services, they'd be able to help more clients like me who need legal assistance. Thank you.
Monina, thank you for testifying in front of Senate Finance today. Is there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next person online to testify is Melba Biggs. Melba, welcome to Senate Finance. If you could identify yourself for the record, any affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Melba Biggs. I'm speaking in support of the SB 49. I was able to use your service, Alaska Legal Services, when my granddaughter was on drugs, her and her husband, and the children were being mistreated and hungry, and so Alaska Legal Services helped me to take the children away from the parents and had them for 3 or 4 years, and their mother got clean and sober, and We were able to get the children back to her, and she has them now, and she's working and doing great. So without the help, I'm 84, and all I get is my Social Security to live on, and so I could never have done it without the help from Alaska Legal Services. Thank you.
Nelma, thank you for joining Senate Finance today. We appreciate your testimony. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, are there any additional people wishing to testify on Senate Bill 49 here in Juneau? Is there anyone online wishing to testify on Senate Bill 49? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Brief at ease. Back on the record, it's 9:35 a.m., and the final bill before the committee this morning is Senate Bill 32. Senate Bill 32, we have a CS before the committee from the Resource Committee. This is a bill that's been introduced at the request of the governor. If I could ask Chris Mashish to the table, he's the Division Director for Forestry under the Department of DNR.
Yes, my name is Chris Mache, Director of the Division of Forestry, for the record. And good morning, Madam Chair and Senators. It's good to be with you here this morning. I appreciate you taking time in your busy agenda to hear this this bill. As Madam Chair discussed, I'm here to talk about the CS for SB 32 Resources version. And this bill proposes to make some changes to our timber sale authorities in the Division of Forestry. And what I thought I would do is talk about those authorities. I'm speaking from a briefing paper that should be in your packet that has, it's two-sided. You may have two pages in your version. And I'm going to speak to the backside of that where there's a review of the five different methods that this Division of Forestry can sell timber. And I think that will help with the changes we're proposing in this bill in context for you and probably answer some questions that you may have. The first authority that we use most frequently, about 90% of the time to sell timber in the state, is called our competitive authority. And I refer to these authorities by the last three digits of the statute, so we call it our 120 authority in shorthand. It requires a competitive bidding, either oral outcry or a sealed bid. And when there's competitive interest, that's the best way to sell timber, and that's the best price that we usually receive. All the other methods of selling timber are forms of negotiated sales. And if you need a copy, if you don't have that, I can pass that over to you, Senator Dunleavy. Did everyone else have a copy of that? Okay, good. Thank you. As I was saying, there's four other methods of selling timber. They're all negotiated sales or different forms of a negotiated sale. The first one we refer to small negotiated sales. It's called the 115 authority. Those are for very small operators. They're only for 1 year in length, and they're for less than 500,000 board feet of timber. And you can see there that we put some acreage equivalents of what that board foot measure would equal in different parts of the state. So roughly that's 20 acres in southeast Alaska, 125 acres in south central Alaska, and 80 acres in interior Alaska. So they're typically for pretty small operations, sole proprietorships, and small mills and value-added processors. The next authority is our high value-added authority, we refer to it as, and that's the 123 authority. And these sales can be up to 10 million board feet over as long as a 10-year period, and that's 10 million board feet per year up to a 10-year period. This authority was designed to help encourage high value-added manufacturing. A good example of that would be the wood pellet mill in Fairbanks. We're in the process of doing 2 5-year sales under this authority to that mill. The definition of high value-added wood products is covered both in statute and in regulation and can be updated as needed as new products and technology invents new wood products that can be considered high value-added. Next, we go to the 118 authority, which is the subject of this proposed legislation. It allows us to negotiate sales for up to 25 years in length. It doesn't require that, but it can allow us to go up to that period of time. And currently, this provision has three requirements that must be in place for us to use this authority. And this is the subject of this bill and some changes that it's proposing. And I'll come back to those in just a second. I want to describe the last authority we have, which is the 117 authority, and that's used for when we have salvage sales, either from fire or insects. It has some expedited process for us so we can salvage that material before it's completely unusable as a wood product. So those are the different suite of tools that we have in our toolbox to sell timber. And the 118 sales are very specific type of sale. The three criteria that are being proposed to be struck from the current legislation is found in subsection C, and it has to do with three specific things that have to be in place to use this authority. Those are a high level of unemployment in the area that this sale would take place in. That's defined in statute, also how we determine that high level of unemployment. There has to be an excess allowable cut in the state forest or the general geographic area that we're going to offer the timber sales in. And the third criteria is there has to be excess manufacturing capacity at the mill that would negotiate a sale under this authority. Right now, it's very difficult to use this authority statewide. The Fairbanks, Kenai, and Mat-Su areas do not meet the criteria for high level of unemployment. And in southern southeast Alaska, where this bill was really originally targeted, for us to sell timber in southern southeast, there's two basic parts of the industry, the log export side of the industry and the manufacturing side of the industry. The state has long had a policy that we would like our timber sales to support jobs and communities in manufacturing and support those communities, so we leverage our timber resources into supporting communities. We are currently almost at our limit on the allowable cut in southern southeast. And when we reach that limit in about 2 years, the only way we'll be able to sell timber in southeast is through the competitive authority. And the round log segment of the industry can outbid the domestic part of the industry. So it's a very important point to understand, and it will really put the state at a disadvantage in supporting communities and manufacturing if we don't have this change in about 2 years. The other thing this bill does is it makes a few changes. In Section 1, it just clarifies that the commissioner can choose which of these authorities is the best way for us to sell timber in the state as part of the preliminary best interest finding process. We add a section in Section 2 on Line 9 just to make clarify that this does require a finding under state law, and that's the formal process we use with most of our decisions. To sell resources in the state is that best interest finding process. That allows public process. Those that comment have the ability to appeal the decision and also potentially take that to a civil process if they are not happy with any results from appealing administratively, a concern that they might have. The other thing it does is it clarifies that not only can this bill be used for wood products, but also a user of wood fiber. And wood fiber was added specifically to address the needs of the biomass industry in the state, particularly up in interior Alaska, where we have several schools now that use wood chips to heat their schools. We have the pellet mill in Fairbanks. There's compressed fuel logs that are made in several locations now in the state. And so we wanted to make it clear that it didn't that it did include wood fiber as an option. There is quite a bit of support for this bill. I think in your packet you'll see letters of support from Southeast Conference, the Alaska Forest Association, the Resource Development Council, the Board of Forestry met yesterday. I don't have the letter resolution that they passed, but they did pass a resolution in full support of this bill. And there's been numerous other folks that have testified in the previous resources committees, both on the House and the Senate. And I will conclude my presentation there and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Quick question. I got a call a year or two ago from some folks that were logging in the interior or wanted to log, and they had mentioned that the duration of the contract was too short for them to go to a lending institution and capitalize, in other words, buy the equipment for the equipment they needed. Can you speak to that? Is that still the case? Is there an issue with the length of contracts?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, it would depend on the authority that we're using, but all of our authorities, especially the 120, the competitive, can be up to any length of time. Typically, we do 3 and 5 year periods of time. But to specifically answer your question, when someone is trying to amortize what will likely be a fairly large investment in manufacturing, they do typically need 15, sometimes 20 years to fully amortize that investment that they make. That's why we have this negotiated sale authority. We have the option of using the 123, the high value added, or we can use the 120. And we will, through that best interest finding process, choose which one of those three methods would be the most appropriate method to do that. And typically, again, we're going to default toward the competitive process because we don't really want to be the in the position of having to decide what proposer might be the one that we select to negotiate with. But in cases like Southeast Alaska, where we're trying to encourage manufacturing, that is the appropriate authority for us to use.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Any further questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, what's it typically take to negotiate a timber sale timeline? Let's say, for example, up to 10 million board feet for a year for 10 years.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the process, we have a series of steps we have to go through. Of course, the preliminary best interest finding, the final best interest finding, and then once the decision is made to do the sale, we also do what's called a forest land use plan, which is another document that has site-specific details once we get out on the ground and cruise it, lay out the road systems. And that also can be appealed by commenters. They can't appeal the decision to do the sale at that point, but they can help change how the sale might look. That process that we were just concluding that I mentioned earlier with the pellet mill in Fairbanks, we've been in that process for just about a year to do from basically start to finish. But that's a fairly ambitious sized project. It's 2 5-year back-to-back timber sales under the 123 authority. And there is competitive interest in the Fairbanks area from other mills, so we had to work through some of that interest to make sure that their interests were protected in terms of a log supply of that. So that added a little bit of a dimension that we had to deal with. It took a little bit of time to work our way through. But to answer your question, I would say anywhere from 12 to 16 months, typically, for a longer-term project like that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I understand that there are very limited state lands on the Kuskokwim River, but knowing that, are there any timber sales on the Kuskokwim that on state lands?
Through the chair, Senator, yes, we've had some interest, again, because of biomass interests in many of our rural communities, and that ranges from, you know, chipping operations to just roundwood operations that are mostly fueling. The garden boilers are very popular in some of the rural parts of the state. And we have had timber sales on state land on the Kuskokwim River in the past, and we continue to respond to requests for timber in that part of the state.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair, will this legislation affect any of those sales?
Through the chair, Senator, it would only affect them if we decided we would use this legislation, this authority to actually sell that timber, but it would not negatively affect our ability to offer any of those sales. More than likely, we will probably use a 120 authority, but again, we'll take a look at the circumstances of what the sale is trying to do and the type of support, and it could be one of these negotiated authorities. We'll make that decision in the preliminary best interest process, and that's the commissioner that makes that decision, and that's delegated essentially to the state forester to make that decision.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. For clarity, the meat of the bill is on page 2, line 1, as we repeal 3805118C. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's where most of the change occurs. The rest of it's just clarification language.
I just want to make sure that the repeal section is really what we should be focusing on. We contacted your office late last night. You were very kind to respond very quickly to me. I was reviewing the state statute in a more holistic approach in our looking at timber sales, and we had, I believe, an antiquated reference on board feet in there. Do we need to change that and put that in this bill? Or do you want to just leave it there?
Madam Chair, I think the section you're referencing to is under 38110, and it does make a reference to what we would consider an older measurement term. It makes reference to MBM, which stands for 1,000 board measure. It's more or less interchangeable with MBF, which is how we usually measure wood volume these days, and that's 1,000 board feet. So if you look up the definition of board measure, it's the same definition as board feet, but it's more structured from a lumber perspective as a log perspective. I don't know that it's necessary to make those changes. We'd probably have to take a close look to see if that reference is in other parts of statute or regulation. I don't believe it is, but that would be something that could easily be changed if you so desired in this process.
Thank you. And my knowledgeable staff just referred me to 3805115 is where that reference is at.
Thank you.
At least that we were looking at.
I think that's correct. I would agree.
Okay. And if it's not necessary to change, I'm happy to leave the definition. I just didn't know what it was, and so we called your office, and you let us know that was board feet.
Yep.
Roman numeral M.
Yes, very good.
With that, I'd like to open the public hearing on the CS for Senate Bill 32 from our Resource Committee, an act relating to the sale of timber on state land and providing for an effective date. Is there anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify on the CS for Senate Bill 32, resources? If you'd identify yourself for the record, any affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Ron Arvin. I'm with the Matsu Borough Assembly. And we took this this up in the form of a resolution of support, had a robust discussion about it, and we supported it 7-0. We think anything that the state can do to help the Division of Forestry be a little more nimble is a good thing. And on a personal note, I'd like to point out that I'm a recovering logger from Southeast. And I say that because I used to work for companies like Gildersleeve Logging that's gone, Whitestone Logging that's gone, Sealy that's gone, Phoenix that's gone, Silver Bay that's gone, Texarkana Timber that's gone, Soderberg Logging that's gone, and Hagen and Sunston Logging that is too gone. So I think anything to try to help the timber industry in Southeast Alaska will do nothing but good for the communities in Southeast in particular. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. Arvin, for joining Senate Finance Committee today. Next off net is Aaron McLarnon. Aaron, are you there?
Yeah, good day. I'm Aaron McLarnon of Anchorage. I'm the Executive Director of the Working Forest Group and a Board of Forestry board member. I am testifying in support of SB 32 that will enable the Commissioner of Natural Resources to better respond to the economic and geographic realities of the forest product industry. Who would have guessed that a primary demand for our state timber would be for biomass energy purposes? SB 32 would allow DNR to offer negotiated timber sales for up to 25 years, which is crucial for medium and large biomass energy projects to get off the ground. This bill would also give DNR the flexibility to determine which applicable sale method is in the best interest of the state for each timber sale, which is a win-win not only for the state of Alaska, but its fiber users. Again, I support SB 32, and I hope you take the necessary steps to move this bill forward. Thank you for your time and service to the state of Alaska.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, Ms. McCarran, thank you so much for joining Senate Finance today. The next person off net, James McCovich.
Yes, this is Jim Muskogak. I'm calling from Gustavus. I like value added. I live in a first-class house built almost completely of wood that was cut in the Tongass. To build a house, I purchased wood from 8 small sawmills in the region. The proposed legislation authorizes 25-year timber sales. I assume this legislation did not materialize out of nowhere and that someone somewhere stands to benefit, but I don't hear anyone talking about building wood processing facilities. This leads me to wonder if the desire is to spend 25 years exporting round logs, then walk away. Long-term sales, such as 25 years, confer special long-term rights to a public resource to the long-term exclusion of others. a negotiated 25-year sale ignores the market, stating that the appraised value of the timber will be redetermined at least every 5 years. It means that everything is subject to determinations by bureaucrats, not the open market. Limiting sales to 5 years and selling them through the bidding process that incorporates a minimum bid is the only way to ensure transparency and to ensure that the public receives fair value in the sale of its resources. I don't support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for testifying. Is there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we do have someone that has entered the Homer LIO. We'll take a brief at ease to see if they can brief at ease.
We're back on the record. We still have the public hearing open for the CS for Senate Bill Number 32, Resources, an act relating to the sale of timber on state lands and providing for an effective date. Heading to our Homer LIO, Steve Gibson, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Dane. Thank you. This is Steve Gibson in Homer. For the last 35 years, I've been making boards up here with primarily state timber. Although I'm not lately the purchaser directly of it, but my supplier of timber is a state customer. It's important to me to see that there are not sweet deals that are made between the owners of between DNR and manufacturers or loggers. 25 years is an extraordinary amount of time, and I understand that there's a lot of infrastructure that's required to process that to justify those that supply length. However, I don't think that 25 years has been a good history with the pulp industry in Southeast. I know that personally, if there were negotiated sales in my neighborhood, whether I was the recipient or not, I would feel like the very system was threatened that encourages me to buy equipment and to go ahead and set up a kiln drying operation and a small remanufacturing process. I think that this is something that private enterprise needs to be able to bid on regularly without sweet deals between the government and one or two manufacturers, processors. I hope that you'll reconsider this 25 years. That seems like a fantastically long period of time to do this. And it sets up a structure of lumber utilization that in the past has not been productive. And I thank you for considering my remarks.
Mr. Gibson, thank you for coming into the Homer LIO and testifying before Senate Finance today. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, thank you, Mr. Gibson. Is there anyone else online wishing to testify on Senate Bill 32? Anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify on Senate Bill 32? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Mr. Mish, thank you. My staff has told me three times it's my fault, not theirs. If you could approach the microphone.
Yes, for the record, Chris Mish, Director, Division of Forestry.
I have to say it 10 more times. Hopefully you understand with a name like Fairclough that it's not meant out of any disrespect.
No problem.
Could you talk to us about the 25-year length and at least two folks who testified that there would not be transparency in the process that the administration might choose to enter into?
Yes, I'd be happy to address that, Madam Chair. It's only up to 25 years, so it's the choice of the division as to what length of time might be necessary to achieve the objectives that would be addressed in the best interest finding process. So just a quick review on that process. A preliminary best interest finding is prepared, which is the proposed action, the method of sale, and essentially how long it might be, 10 years, 5 years, 20 years, as well as outlining why it would be necessary for that length of sale. Of course, that is open to interagency comment as well as public comment. We take that comment, we respond to all of it, typically in a matrix form where like comments are lumped together. We often will make changes to that preliminary best interest finding and then author the final best interest finding, which is the decision document that either affirms a sale or denies the sale. People that have commented have appeal rights at that point, administrative appeal rights, and after the administrative appeal rights are exhausted, they also have the ability to pursue a civil case against the decision that's made. As I mentioned, we then also have what's called the Forest Land Use Plan, a FLUP, and that's another both interagency review and public review document where people, again, have a chance to comment on the sale but not on the decision whether we sell it or not at that point. It's really on the design aspects of the sale. And probably the most frequently thing item that's discussed is access and a road, where the road might be constructed. There's typically people want a road and there's other people that don't want the road near their property. So that's often something we have to work out. I did want to address one other key point. One of the public commenters was concerned that we could do a large negotiated sale for someone that would export this logs. And the statute specifically says a manufacturer, which means an onshore processor, domestic. So this authority cannot be used to negotiate a sale for round log export. The only way we can do that is through the competitive bid process, which would essentially be an open market competition and address the market issue the gentleman mentioned.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that would be consistent with the governor's talked about getting the value added out of a resource.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct. The governor and the administration is definitely wants to try and squeeze as many jobs as we can out of each timber sale that the state sells, and that would definitely be consistent with trying to encourage that domestic manufacturing.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up. Help me on this one because I'm going to get – my zeal is going to get ahead of my knowledge here. But it would appear to me that this could also have a safety value to help DNR meet their mission on fuels around local communities where you might be able to go in and in some of these areas where there's a lot of the smaller black spruce where we could go back and offer a longer-term sale maybe – to go have some of this preventative forestry practices to eliminate maybe an incident around a rural community?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Bishop, you raise a good point. A lot of the biomass activity in interior Alaska, which has really increased dramatically in the last 5 to 6 years. Literally, if you look at the map of where there are various biomass activities, it is statewide from small communities to large, and it's a very proactive way for us to manage fuels that are close into communities. Probably one of the better examples is Tok. They've been making this investment in their biomass industry for quite a number of years, and we've made significant progress in reducing dangerous fuels that are close into the community. So, of course, that in turn helps us when we have wildland fire, which we do in interior Alaska every summer. You're all well aware of the amount of energy and time that goes into that aspect of the Division of Forestry's duties, and anything we can do to help reduce that risk and actually earn some money while we're reducing that risk is a plus. So I think that hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions from committee members? My last question is, do you already have the authority to issue contracts up to 25 years?
Yes, we do, and we can do that, as I mentioned, also under our 120 authority. There's no time limit on the competitive sales statute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anything else to come before the Senate Finance Committee today, this morning? This afternoon's agenda for Wednesday, March 25th, 2015, at 1:30 p.m., we'll have SCR1, Civic Education Task Force. We had been pending referral on Senate Bill 57, the Clean Air Act Plan. We do not have that in our possession, so we will not be taking up that particular issue. So the only thing as of right now on this afternoon's schedule will be the Civics Education Task Force. I would say that I've reviewed the documents. They're thick, and there are several people that are very passionate about this issue. So we've asked, invited testimony to stay at 5 minutes each. There is a constituent that is very passionate about it that I've asked to restrain his testimony to 5 minutes. So it will be up to the committee. There are people passionate about this issue, and I just wanted to prepare the committee appropriately for this afternoon. With that, we're adjourned.
Good afternoon. It is 4 minutes after 2. Today is March 25th, 2015. With me at the table, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Olson, welcome. Myself, Senator McKinnon, and I expect to be joined shortly by other Finance Committee members. We were delayed on the floor this afternoon, so folks might be trying to get something to eat or already in other meetings. Today before the committee is SCR1. It's a proposal for a civic education task force. With us at the table, Mr. Tim Lampkin from Senator Stevens' office. Welcome, if you could identify yourself for the record and roll out your proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, Senator McKinnon. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Gary Stevens. Senator Stevens should or could very well be here any moment to join me, as we all are quite busy today, but we want to thank you for hearing this bill. In short, we just want to share with you the fact that there seems to be a quiet epidemic amongst our students and youth in the country, apathy and ignorance. Even for decades, we focus now, particularly with regard to adopting the No Child Left Behind, an increasing focus on math, science, reading, writing, and testing. And the question being is, for what? Are we training good worker bees when we maybe should be also considering training leaders and good thinkers? Liberal arts has been left behind, and other states have taken notice of this with a wide range of policies that they have adopted over the years, several various types of adjustments to in fact include a list that I've compiled for your consideration of a total of 77 laws and policies adopted since 95, when in fact those things include things such as changes in curriculum, exit exams in civics, observing things like what they call a Freedom Week or Lincoln's Birthday, flag etiquette, community involvement, volunteerism, an increase in an encouragement of registering to vote, those types of activities. In Alaska, the only activity that we have done, as I believe you should see in your packet, is in 2000 we adopted House Bill 192, which requires school districts to regularly recite the Pledge of Allegiance, or they may, of course, opt out as a moment of silence. But that's the only substantive thing that we have done in Alaska since 95. One movement embraces, for example, and you'll hear from a gentleman here shortly, that embraces a quiz, the same quiz that is used by the Department of Immigration Services, that in order for folks coming into the country to get their citizenship, they have to take a 100-question quiz. And, for example, you know, what are the branches of government? What's the purpose of the First Amendment? What was the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and so forth? And surprisingly, as you, I think, will hear and also see in the packet, that of these 100 questions, it only takes 60%, 60 of 100, to get those questions correctly in order to pass and to get your citizenship. Well, there's folks, these immigrants that are coming to the country, 92% of them are passing this test. That same test was given a few years ago in Arizona and Oklahoma to graduating high school seniors, and only 3% in Arizona are passing that very same test, and only 4% in Oklahoma are passing that test at that time. So there's a substantial amount of research out there that makes it clear that our youth is disassociated pretty much from our republic. They don't seem to care. They're apathetic. This effort that we have before you is an attempt to reverse that trend, make an investment in our future, and SCR1 would establish a task force to carefully look at this issue, ascertain what we're doing here now, what's happening elsewhere, bring forth a number of options that the legislature might embrace, not necessarily any unfunded mandates or increased costs and so forth, but just to look and see how we can improve civics education in our state. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I see that my esteemed senator has now joined us to follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gary Stevens, District P, I really apologize for getting stuck with a few of my constituents that wouldn't let me go, but I appreciate your hearing this bill, and appreciate Tim's being here to explain it. Knows as much as I do about it, if not more. The idea here is very simple, that we do need to find a way to help the children of Alaska become more involved in politics, in voting, in being citizens in their own community. And this is the point we're trying to get across here. As I was talking with you earlier, Madam Chair, I was mentioning a study that was made probably 15 years ago, a very similar study, but it was done by folks that were not legislators. and nothing ever happened to it. It was put on the shelf. This task force, I believe, will lead in some really strong suggestions that we can actually enforce. Now, I know we're in a tough time, and we've been talking about the financial situation we're in. I'm perfectly willing to zero out the fiscal note on this, and we will make it work without a fiscal note. But I do believe that things have been done around the country that we can learn from. For example, in Boston, they were able to, in New Hampshire, they were, I'm sorry, not in Boston, Massachusetts, they had a task force that wound up, one of the suggestions was to bring industry together, put some money together, and bring teachers into Boston and try to help them figure out how they could teach civics in their classrooms that they were already teaching. Not a separate class, not demanding a civics education class, but in fact finding a way to incorporate that throughout the curriculum. So I think that's the way I'd like to go with this task force. I think it'll make some good recommendations and cost-effective recommendations that we can actually accomplish and make things better for our children.
Senator Stephen, thank you for those remarks. Mr. Lampkin, thank you for those remarks. I wanted to make sure Senator Machicki joined us some time ago, and we appreciate you coming to the table, too. Welcome, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Donovan.
Thank you. Just a statement. I commend the Senator for looking at this issue. As was stated, the percentage of folks that are eligible to vote seems to be dropping. It's certainly not growing. Several years ago, when Iraq had its first election, I think upwards of 79% of the folks voted in the face of being assassinated, blown up, etc. Remember, they put their finger or their thumb in the inkwell to indicate that they already voted. 22 countries in the world mandate voting. Australia fines you if you don't vote. President Obama has been talking about this issue. And the only statement I would make, and I'll have future conversations with the senator, is and I think Tim brought it up, is the folks that come to the country, they want to come to the country, they study for the test, they want to be Americans, and they want to partake in it. And the devil's going to be in the details. It's kind of it's a values issue. And I do believe that hopefully through your work, we can instill a desire, a value to, once again, demonstrate to people that we've had Americans, hundreds of thousands of Americans die to protect our right to be who we are. Unfortunately, part of being who we are is also the choice not to vote, which I, like many, think is problematic. But to make a long story short, it'll be very interesting to see what the outcomes are, and I hope that it actually could make a difference.
Thank you to Senator Dunleavy. Could we put on the record, Senator Stevens, exactly who is being proposed in this piece of legislation for participation in the task force?
Certainly, that's gone through several iterations, and Tim, if you would read through those names, or those positions.
Sure. Through the chair, currently version P before you has a task force membership that would consist of three representatives from the House of Representatives, one of which would be from the Minority Caucus. Correspondingly, there'd be three senators from the Senate, and one of which would be from their Minority Caucus. One would be the designee of the Department of Education, the commissioner or his or her designee. One representative would be from NEA, and that specifically would have some experience and background in civics education. One person would be appointed that would represent the school boards in our state. We've also got one person that would represent a student body. That would be a senior in high school with demonstrated interest in civics and or leadership. We also would have one member that would represent the judiciary, that being particularly a judge, and then finally one person that would be representing the University of Alaska. Total members of 12 members.
Thank you for putting that on the record. What I'd like to do now with the support of the committee is Senator Stevens has asked for some invited testimony, and so I'd like to go to the invited testimony prior to opening the public hearing. First, I'm not sure if he is here or off net. Mr. Lampkin, is Michael Polyakov here or off net?
Madam Chairman, he should be online at this time.
Online. Mr. Polyakov, are you with us?
Yes.
We can barely hear you, sir.
Is this better now?
It is. If you could identify yourself for the record, we have a PowerPoint presentation on a screen ready to go.
Thank you so much, Senator McKinnon. I'm Michael Polyakov, Vice President of Policy of the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, and I thank you and Mr. Lampkin and Senator Stevens and the Senate Finance Committee for the opportunity to be part of this discussion of this vital initiative to improve civic education. The American Council of Trustees and Alumni, since its founding in 1995, has been deeply committed to the imperative of a citizenry that understands America's free institutions and their history. Could we go to slide 2, please? Civic education must be based on civic knowledge and understanding of America's institutions of government. I note that SCR 1 properly starts with a call to assess the state of civic education. I would suggest that no student should leave high school without a strong foundation in United States history, including how the institutions of government developed. No student should leave college, especially a publicly funded university, without a mature, collegiate grasp of American history and the successes and failures of our free institutions. Our founders were keenly aware that the lifespan of liberty is unlikely to be long without well-informed, participating citizens. Slide 3, please. Nationwide, our free institutions are threatened by a plague of ignorance and undereducation in civic matters. The American Council surveys college students and college graduates regularly to assess the state of historical and civic knowledge. The results are terrifying. Slide 4, please. These are not College Bowl or Trivial Pursuit questions. Voters who do not even know the term lengths of the representatives they elect are unlikely to be making well-informed decisions. And that's, of course, an understatement. We know from the 2006 Pew Research Center report that only 26% of the 18 to 29-year-olds could name Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State, and only 15% knew that Vladimir Putin was President of Russia. In the 1998 survey of teenagers by the National Constitution Center, only 41% could name the three branches of government, but 51% could name the three stooges. Slide 5, please. There's a cause and effect issue here, and we might now turn to remedies. I note that the proposed legislation looks toward best practices in other states. Texas, Georgia, and Nevada have legislation for public universities that requires all students to take coursework within their core curricular requirements or to pass examinations in United States history and government. Recently, as Mr. Lankin noted, Arizona and North Dakota have passed laws mandating that students pass examinations showing civic literacy. Alaska does very well to consider the practices of states that require coursework based on knowledge and understanding of the primary documents of American and state government. These are not expensive initiatives to sound the alarm and to get remedies, getting the people and the legislature focused on things that will work. It's true that community service projects are part of an important ethic characteristic of our nation. They are a key part of religious and civic associations. But schools and colleges are the unique and essential place for teaching and learning about America's history and government. And this legislation properly looks towards schools. No other institution will reliably fill the gap left by weak educational standards. It is my hope that the initiative of SCR 1 will lead to new requirements in Alaska, both at the K-12 and the collegiate level, that will turn back the dangerous tide of historical and civic illiteracy that is now so prevalent in so many places in the United States, and will set a very high example for other states to follow. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you for this important discussion.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Mr. Polyakov, one of the discussions that has been going on for some time involving this particular topic is not just exposure to the founding documents, Declaration of Independence, even Articles of Confederation, Constitution, and Federalist Papers, but how do you, you have some division within the ranks of folks who are well-versed in these issues. Some believe that the Constitution is a living document. Some believe it's static. Some believe that there should be more weight to given to maybe a certain voices in the founding of this country. Others feel there's a difference that we should be listening to modern voices in America. How does one settle upon at least, if not one, at least the narrow view of how the interpretation of these documents should be shared with students both in public school and college?
It is certainly a best practice within the world of education to bring case studies, real-life examples of how our system of government works. And we should be perfectly honest, there are times when it doesn't work well. But it is the core knowledge that allows us to have that discussion. There is no substitute for the civic empowerment that comes from knowing the laws that we have, the institutions of government we have, and how we got them. And so in that regard, we've got to stop the civic disempowerment that comes from such appalling ignorance as we find. And of course, as I said before, the case study method is one way in which the core documents are adequately studied and their application as living documents can come to the fore.
Hey, thank you. Just two quick comments.
Certainly.
Putin was also premier as well as president. And I think there were four stooges, Curly, Moe, Shimp, and Larry, just for that.
I would allow that fourth one, although they're classically the three, but point taken.
Michael, thank you for joining Senate Finance Committee. We appreciate the abbreviated presentation.
Delighted to be with you.
Next online in invited testimony is Samuel Stone. Samuel is the Executive Director of the Civics Education Initiative. Mr. Stone, are you with us? And if you are, please identify
yourself. Yes, I am.
If you could identify yourself.
Thank you for having me today. My name is Samuel Stone. I'm the Executive Director of the Civics Education Initiative at the Joe Fox Institute. And as Mr. Polyakov mentioned, we're actually the organization that's promoted legislation first in Arizona and North Dakota, and now we've also had it passed in South Dakota, Utah, and are very close in several other states regarding some very basic civics requirements that we've asked schools to perform for their students in terms of having them take and pass the USCIS civics and history exam as part of their curriculum. That's something that we support, but we also, as an institute, support the broader knowledge of civics, and I think Mr. Polyakov outlined the problem rather perfectly, and I don't need to go into all the statistics. One study after another really shows all the same things. We are failing our kids in this knowledge. It's certainly not their fault. It's very much on us to focus on what we can do to improve civics education for our students. But first, I would just ask all of you in the room as legislators, and I've had the chance this year to meet legislators from across the country in about 20 different states, why you got into this business and why you're doing the things you're doing. And I've never met a legislator who got into it because they're going to become fabulously wealthy or have their feats recorded throughout the annals of history. Every legislator I've ever met does it because they want to make some small difference in the lives of the people in their state and their community. And you can't do that without an understanding of how our government works. And so to get more people like you, to get more people who are eager to engage in that process, we need to make sure kids have that knowledge. And so obviously, whether you end up with the current fiscal note or zeroing it out, even at the current fiscal note, you're talking about an investment of pennies per student for every student in Alaska. Nebraska to give this task force a chance to look at options for what kind of knowledge that schools can impart, how you can improve those programs, ways to engage them actively in their communities, ways to transfer that learning and that knowledge into action that benefits a much broader populace. And so I think that really needs to be the main focus here is we have an obligation as adults to this next generation and to every generation that follows to ensure that they have the opportunity to engage and do the things that we're all doing here today. And that we've all in our lives made a commitment to work and fight for, right? But we all agree on how we can work together through our system of government. We need to stress that. And one last comment, and I'll be available for questions after, but relating to the previous question, in terms of a narrative to civics and history, I like to say, look, narrative speak for itself. We have the words of our founders. Students can go back and read them. They debated. Some of them thought the Constitution should be a living document, and some thought it should be a static document. It continued as part of the great growth of our society. And I really very much encourage you to authorize this task force and give them to really look at programs that can benefit students. And there are a lot of nonprofits like the one I work with, the Civic Renewal Network, all sorts of groups across the country that offer plenty of materials and different programs that can be looked at as models for this kind of thing. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Stone? Seeing and hearing none, thank you, Mr. Stone, for joining the Senate Finance Committee today.
Thank you.
With that, with the support of the committee, I'd like to open the public hearing on SCSCR1 Education, the task force. Public hearing is open. Stuart Thompson. Stuart, we have your written testimony. We've spoken earlier. Please identify yourself for the record, any affiliation, and proceed with your comments.
Thank you, ma'am. The material you have was directed at the Education Committee. I have coordinated in days past with your aide about allowing time for my precise fiscal testimony on SCR1. I'm effectively honoring what you demanded to be allowed the special consideration to give specific well-founded income planning testimony to support SCR1. So for the record, greetings to the chair people and members of the Senate Finance Committee. I am Stuart Thompson, an informed citizen of Senator Huggins District, here to give fiscal testimony in support of SCR1 on behalf of myself and four other citizens who generally agree with my testimony. I have 5.5 minutes of prepared fiscal testimony, giving five standalone medium to long range fiscal solutions to offer. Ms. Chairwoman, may I proceed?
Please proceed.
Okay. Start of testimony. I call on the legislature's finance committees to have the humility to consider thinking outside of the box to increase funding streams while simultaneously cutting expenditures, the proven way to handle fiscal troubles. In SCR1's case, investing $1,500 to eventually reap billions from creating more competent citizens should be a no-brainer. Still, I offer for your consideration standalone means of covering the fiscal impact of SCR1 and its inevitable task force recommendations. They all arise from our political heritage, they don't call for new taxes, and don't rob Peter to pay Paul, and any of them would pay for things. Number one, the volume of true citizen participation in government of, for, and by the people is probably the most reliable test for public education effectiveness that could ever be. In other words, if we are not getting volume citizen participation in our system of self-government, effectively encouraging life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, Alaska is being ripped off by its education spending, and you officials are unwittingly condoning it. So lean on the Alaska Bar Association to provide pro bono legal services to investigate and prosecute fraud and embezzlement and fraudulent compliance to our Constitution's Article 7. They should target education contractors and subject matter dictators like textbook vendors and federal government-supported special interests. Consider, if the state paid for bridge construction, and the bridge failed spectacularly from shoddy work and materials. We would sue the contractor, right? This method might take a while, but we could recover millions. Number two, arrange for PFD donations, click give, to defray Alaska civics education costs. This avoids the dedicated funding prohibitions on the legislature. The legitimacy of this artifice is completely supported by our Constitution's Article 1, Section 1. It can be truthfully pitched as a direct way for citizens to increase future PFDs. If even half of PFD recipients gave $5, there'd be well over $1 million to defray the costs of teaching true civics and our political heritage. Number three, if you take off the social engineering arbitraries forced on teachers and make students actually practice methodologies of our political heritage through assisting in their own education, current funding would suffice. Look at all the money that would be saved from not paying for goon administrators, drugs, and prison school design that are absolutely necessary to support the current methodologies of school feudalism, territorial rule by nobles. What am I saying? Consider the supreme hypocrisy of treating kids as dumb, unruly peasants while toothlessly teaching them about our heritage of liberty and justice. Students should naturally laugh and jeer at this, call free speech, but they don't dare because they rightly fear feudal punishment. Example, look into Juno's bong hits for Jesus student reprisal incident. Number four, have the UAA sell some of its land to contribute funding for civics education. It's actually a natural investment that will drive up tuition income. How's this? Encouraging self-govern early forces people's faces into how they need to acquire more skills and secondhand information to achieve their ambitions or dreams for themselves and others. Example, if a young person conceives that it is a necessity for posterity's welfare to develop and get utilized environmentally friendly mining technology, and riding the wave of this would make him wealthy, he'd be on to going to university like flies on excrement. Number five, the most powerful solution to getting civics and our full political heritage taught is to use the power of civic participation itself. Have the governor openly ask Alaskans of every political stripe, liberal, libertarian, and conservative, to donate time to explain in classrooms their take on government with substantiation from the documents within our political heritage. Students would be first carefully educated, observing the discipline of the scientific method, that opinions and schemes derived from repeatedly verified principles are never as valuable as the principles themselves. This is the answer to fears of susceptibility to propaganda and mind control. This way, volunteers also don't get accused of and punished for allegedly corrupting youth like Socrates. Here are two quotes from U.S. founding fathers that elaborate on what I mean. Shake up all the fears of servile prejudices under which weak minds are servilely crouched. Fix reason firmly in her seat and call on our tribunal for every fact, every opinion. Question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear. Thomas Jefferson. An army of principles will penetrate where an army of soldiers cannot. It will succeed where diplomatic management would fail. It is neither the Rhine, the Channel, nor the ocean that can arrest progress. It will march on the horizons of the world, and it will conquer. Thomas Paine. Note, I pray that God sends to hell the federal government big shots that don't follow these principles. Good luck on your deliberations. The text of this testimony will be faxed in to help.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. We appreciate your testimony. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Just a comment for Mr. Thompson. I'm reading through the, listening to the testimony and reading through the packet, and it's fascinating, and I appreciate you sending it in. It's very enlightening, and I'm not just saying that. I just want to read one quote that he has in here, which I think is interesting. It says, "We're not stupid people, far from it. We're actually more educated than any generation in history, but we simply haven't been paying attention as citizens." Anyway, I just want to thank him for that.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Thompson, for testifying in front of Senate Finance Committee today. Is there anyone else here in Juneau wishing to testify on Senate Concurrent Resolution 1? Is there anyone online wishing to testify on Senate Concurrent Resolution 1? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Senator Stevens, any final comments before we set the bill aside?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we have to understand there's more, and I know you do, than to civics education than the foundational documents. And as important as they are, they certainly are crucial, but there's a lot more. There's classes that students take in history and democracy and economics and government. There are I guess I was very fortunate in the school to have studies current events as well as the democratic processes, and certainly we even had mock legislatures to learn how legislatures work and studied parliamentary procedures. So I guess I was lucky there. I guess if you don't mind, I'd like to close up with something I usually would like to start with, and apologize for not being able to be here earlier, but I'd like to quote my favorite historical personage in American history, and that's Benjamin Franklin. I know Senator Dunleavy is familiar with him as well. But Franklin, in 1787, when he was writing the new Constitution, and he and others in Philadelphia, as he left that room, they had written the Constitution. A lady stopped him in Philadelphia and said this, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And his answer was very simple. He said, "A republic, if you can keep it." That's the key thing. He didn't say if the president can keep it, he didn't say if the governor can keep it, he didn't say if Congress can keep it, he said if you can keep it. And that's the danger we face if the youths of this country, you and me and our children and grandchildren, are not really prepared as they should to protect democracy. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, perfectly willing to see this zeroed out as in terms of a fiscal note. I realize the problems you're facing. If we move ahead with this, I can guarantee you I will find members of a task force who will make this even better than a zero budget. I bet they'll give you money to serve on this task force. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Not for the money, but for the presentation. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing none, I'd like to advise you that on Thursday, March 26, 2015, in the Senate Finance Committee Room 532, at 9 a.m. tomorrow, we'll be taking up SB 34, Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund Investments, and SGR 2, a constitutional amendment looking at geo bonds for student loans. On Thursday, we'll be taking up in the afternoon bills previously heard. With that, we're adjourned.